Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Piki mai, kake mai, and welcome to Our Changing World. Ko Alison Balance, tēnei. Climate change has been very much on the international agenda in the past week. World leaders met for the Climate Action Summit at the United Nations in New York. School students around the world are striking, demanding action to curb greenhouse gas emissions. The World Meteorological Organization reported that the five-year period from 2014 to 2019 is the warmest on record. Sea level rise has accelerated significantly over the same period, it says, and CO2 emissions have hit new highs. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has released a special report on the ocean and cryosphere in a changing climate. Cryosphere basically means ice. And, as we've reported on in Our Changing World many times over the past decade, the ice is melting. The Greenland ice sheet, the West and East Antarctic ice sheets, the glaciers in our Southern Alps, all seem to be melting faster than we expected or hoped. Growing numbers and sizes of icebergs calving from glaciers and from ice shelves in both the Arctic and the Antarctic are one of the symptoms of this melt. So it's fitting that one of the calls to action ahead of the New York Climate Action Summit was an installation by New Zealand artist and photographer Joseph Michael. In Voices for the Future, Joseph projected virtual icebergs onto the United Nations buildings in Manhattan with a soundtrack of music and the voices of young people calling for change. I collaborated with Joseph on the award-winning podcast Voice of the Iceberg, which charted the expedition that Joseph and a team of filmmakers made to the Antarctic Peninsula to record the sights and sounds of icebergs. Tonight, to mark this growing focus on climate change, ice melt and rising sea levels, I'm going to replay the second episode of Voice of the Iceberg, Revelation. In episode one, Joseph and the team travelled from the southern tip of South America by yacht and encountered their first icebergs, discovering that each iceberg has a unique sound. In this episode, they begin to photograph and record the sounds of the bergs, which they give names to. You'll hear from photographer Joseph Michael, behind-the-scenes director Ryan McNeil, safety guide Nick Fluvier, sound recordist Mark Michelle, a.k.a. Mitch, and skipper of the yacht Australis, Roger Wallace. Here's Joseph.
This is a New Zealander. We're fairly aware of Antarctica. There's a lot of connections there, and we're always hearing stories about it. But, you know, finding out how huge it is, a lot of people don't really understand how huge it is. I certainly didn't.
It's nice and dead out there with the snow today.
Well, it's much easier when it's still like this. Yesterday was a bit of a mission.
Yeah.
That's what's nice about this, actually. See the little light dusting of snow we've got on it? It's giving it some beautiful highlights.
I'm Mike Williams, and I'm physical oceanographer at NIWA and also director of the Deep South National Science Challenge. Antarctica has got all this ice because basically it's cold. So any rainfall or anything like that is always going to be snow. But what's important to understand about Antarctica is there's actually two types of ice. There's sea ice, which is frozen seawater, and then we have the continental ice. And that's where we get our icebergs from. So although we always evoke the image of icebergs being adrift in the sea, they're actually land ice that has come off the continent and is drifting out to sea.
This is really interesting. I like this one, eh? Like even in through here, it's beautiful. And look at the lines, it's like dripping paint.
Big Berg.
There are different kinds of icebergs. Some we describe by their shape. So, for example, we talk about tabular icebergs, which are the sort of the big, flat, square ones. And then we also define iceberg by their names. And there's some great names. For example, very small ones we talk about as Bergie Bits. But then once we get to the larger ones, they're kind of, the names are a bit less exciting. It's kind of small, medium, large, extra large.
Brash ice, just the really small ones, all this really small broken up stuff. Yeah, once they get as big as the boat sort of thing, you've got to call them icebergs then.
Icebergs, okay.
Yeah. By the time, big growlers, you don't want to hit big growlers at speed. You can damage the prop or dent the hull or just knock your paintwork around. Brash ice doesn't do much harm at all. Any of this ice is really too big and too hard to hit at speed. You can sort of bump into it a bit, a glancing blow, but once the bergs get too big, you don't want to get your rigging caught up in them. And then you've got to think of your propeller and rudder.
Every iceberg is different. It's like the flames of a fire. Everything, just all different, just continually different. Yeah. You just wonder how there can be so many different shapes.
As scientists, when we try and study icebergs or try and incorporate them into our models and things like that, is we have to start treating them as cubes with rules, which really doesn't capture their individual nature. Icebergs have been carved by nature over time, by the little processes where little things have melted, where individual waves have eroded icebergs, where they've rolled, where they've collided. They're a bit like people who have a life story, and it's their life story that has shaped how they are when we see them.
I can't fit it in any of my lenses. I need to go wider.
I guess the easiest way to explain scale and size would be to liken them to large buildings. We are looking at pieces of ice which above the water look like a fairly large three-story building, and realizing that below the surface there's even more under there. There's this immense piece of ice deep down under the water below the boat as well. Quite a sense of scale, make you feel pretty small.
No choice. We'll go around this and then we might pull up alongside and just send Nick up the crow's nest just to see, because we might come back with the drone.
I grabbed a hold of the fleet of GoPros and ended up being the guy that would climb the mast and fix cameras around the place. And I really spent a lot of time up the mast. If we were photographing or surface mapping the bigger icebergs, I would be up the mast. I loved being able to see into the water. I really, really remember that. I could see the ice below the surface, and at times when we're motoring around a big iceberg with a soaring wall much higher than the mast, if I looked down into the water, I could see that there's, reefs of ice below the boat that we're motoring over. There's this immense amount of ice below the surface that we just couldn't see from on deck.
We talk about the tip of the iceberg, and the reason for that story is that we know around about a seventh to a tenth of the iceberg is all that's visible above the water, and the rest is sitting down below the water. And that comes just from the different density that ice has to water. So if we've got lots of ice and snow, then the iceberg will sit a bit higher in the water, but if it's pure ice, it'll sit lower. And what that means, of course, is as the iceberg gets smaller, its top sits lower and lower and lower. So we're able to make some really good estimates about how much of an iceberg is underwater just by looking at the shape of what we can see above water. So we visualise the big ones as being tens of metres tall or hundreds of kilometres long, but icebergs can be any size down to a couple of meters. floating in the ocean with their heads just above the water.
Yoko was a very small berg. It's only, two and a half metres wide, very delicate. And it was just a peculiar looking thing. It was unusual and it was something that we hadn't seen before. And that was what I was looking for. I was looking for different shapes and different surfaces and also different looking icebergs. So it wasn't a clear iceberg, but it was a very blue looking colour. And it had an unusual look to it. It had very thin ice flakes on it. And as we got closer, I mean, we were probably still 10 metres or so away from it. Over the sound of the engine, I could hear this popping and cracking coming from it. And so I think before I even photographed it, I sent Mitch in with the hydrophone to capture what the hell was going on.
Now, I remember Yoko, Mark and I went out in the tender together, and Yoko was relatively small, was beautiful, sculptured, quite a melted iceberg, so very glassy ice. The light refracting through that was quite something. But that was all about sound when we went out with Mark.
It was bubbling and fizzing away. It kind of sounded like that magic gum you have as a kid, or like bacon and eggs. And there was these tiny little flakes of ice that are sort of cracking and breaking. It was amazing. It was fantastic.
Yoko was an angry little thing, incredibly boisterous. It was quite small, but quite a dense ice, so quite an older ice in its makeup. And it was fizzing and crackling and spitting, almost like it was on fire. It had this kind of ember burning sonic to it. And it was incredible that something so small could be emanating such an incredibly loud and boisterous sonic. So I started just cruising around Yoko with the stereo mics, using a mono mic as well, so that I could try and target some of the real particular sounds that were happening within it, and also started using the hydrophone at this point around the icebergs. I think this was the first iceberg that I used the hydrophone, and again that was producing a lot of really loud pops and fizzes.
Because of that whole compression process, when the snow was turned into ice, as it gets squeezed, then all the air that was trapped inside the ice or inside the snow and the ice is all compressed, and the gas is squeezed down into bubbles at really high pressure. A little bit like if it's in a dive tank or a CO2 cylinder in a soda stream. So then when we pop that piece of ice in water and it starts melting, and the gas just starts bubbling out of that and generates a little bit of fizz in the ice.
It was quite something here, and that popping, crackling, it was constant, constantly cracking and popping. And Yoko was the only one that seemed to do, she just did that. The other icebergs, depending on where you went around them, you would hear different sounds. Sometimes you drop the hydrophone in the water and you might hear cracking and popping. Other icebergs, the deep booming sounds that you'd capture. I was amazed at all the frequencies we were hearing, deep, deep, deep booming sounds right up to really high treble crackling and pops. They're alive, they're constantly changing. Everything's moving, sort of impermanent, I guess.
So once it's drifting around the ocean, the The two things that are going to control where it goes are the wind and the ocean currents, and they act to steer the iceberg. But at the same time, what's also happening is the bottom is melting. It's now exposed to much warmer water underneath, and so it's, the bottom is slowly melting away, and that starts to make it nice and round and smooth. And we also have waves hitting the side of the iceberg, and the waves start carving away at the side of the iceberg. So it starts to become unstable as it melts in different places and erodes in different places. So it will potentially roll, or big pieces will come off it, or it will carve mini icebergs off the side of it. So it becomes a very dynamic beast that changes its shape and its orientation as it goes through its journey, which could be, in some cases, decades, because if they don't escape from Antarctica, they still stay in relatively cold water, so they can survive for a long time.
From early on, I wanted to find some way of representing scale. In a lot of my landscape photographs, it's very hard to figure out exactly how big the landscape is. You know, it's very easy if you put a boat or if you put something in the frame, but I like to keep, especially my photography, I like to keep the landscape as pure as possible. So it was just an answer to that question, is how I would represent Antarctica and icebergs in a way that doesn't involve putting a human object in there. That sort of developed into the scale is all the buildings that we're surrounded by around the city, you know, are quite representative of what icebergs look and feel like. And so it just seemed logical to take an iceberg and wrap a building. I knew I wanted to map these icebergs, but I didn't entirely know the correct procedure for that, or how I would do it, or how it would become useful in post, or because they're not definite shapes. They're kind of circles, and they have many sides to them.
So Roger's going to take us on a bit of a ticky-tow around, because he reckons there's some really spectacular ones over the other side, and then we can kind of get a feel, come back tonight, and then work out a couple to sort of map, and maybe on the way out.
When we first went out, we went out in the Zodiac and we were circling around in the Zodiac, and then we worked out that wasn't going to be appropriate for mapping the bergs. Then we had to call in the big guns and we actually, you know, we circumnavigated the icebergs with the big yacht.
That's good, yep.
So my name is Thomas Helita, and I'm an actual cinematographer or photographer. So I was sort of a visual Swiss Army knife in a way. We would ask the captain of the boat to sail around it, to rotate around it, and I would basically be on deck.
Make a slow turn there.
And try to capture as many photos.
Yeah, that's good.
Of the side of the iceberg, of the actual cliffs, as the boat was moving.
We would literally travel from one iceberg and then we would loop around it a couple of times.
If you could just pop it in neutral just as we cruise onto this corner, Roger, it'd be good.
You'd detect the iceberg on the radar, and depending on how far I wanted to be away, say if I wanted to be 10 or 20 metres away, he would just set it on the radar and keep that radius from the iceberg as we travelled round.
Yeah, we'll just loop right around it again, Roger. Next up, he just wants to get a glimpse into the inside just to see...
The path that the boat takes, there's a GPS map of it, and that people can research that on the internet. And so back home, Roger was getting emails from people wondering why we were doing all these circly, loopy, weird trips in the boat, because we were circling round and round icebergs and it looked really strange that they hadn't seen that before. There we go. There was a number of things that I wanted to capture, so I was mapping, photographically mapping the icebergs. So I had Thomas was helping me with the assistance of mapping the icebergs. I would operate one camera on a wider lens, and Thomas would be on a tighter lens capturing photographic panels. So we had huge resolution plates of the icebergs.
And then later on in the post-production process, we would actually ask the software to stitch, to put all the photos together. A good metaphor is an orange skin. So you imagine how the iceberg is an orange, and you can just imagine peeling off the skin of the orange and put it flat, and then we would project this, wrap this in a way around the building when we got back in Auckland.
So the aim was to find, you know, at least 10 icebergs that we could photographically map. And the other thing that was essential was to and difficult, obviously, is to capture ice crashing and carving off the side of the icebergs and glaciers, so we can then use that as part of the installation.
Well, so if there's an archway in a building, we'll probably use that and try and...
With Valentine, it was 14th of February. It was close to a rock outcrop, so we could film the iceberg from it, and it had this huge archway that looked like it was about to collapse.
Oh, this piece in the middle of the archway looks like it's just ready to drop.
So the rest of the team spent a whole day sitting in front of Valentine to capture this ginormous archway.
Yeah, I've got there's a pre-record function on the camera, which I'll enable, which means I can just wait for the moment that the ice falls, hit the button, and it will record the previous 20, 30 seconds. So it's a good little feature, which hopefully means we can grab it, but it's a bit hit and miss because it's pretty unpredictable.
Part of it carved off during the day. We were sitting there, and we spent a good 10 hours or more, I think, all day and right up into the evening. Of course, it's not dark until 10 or 11, and we got some fabulous footage, and I got some great audio. And we were just waiting. We knew that this archway was going to move at some point.
Valentine, I got up about 5 a.m. and the light was really nice. Some mornings you'd just get a little tickle of sunrise. So I grabbed my camera while the other guys were getting the rest of the camera gear ready, and I went out on the Zodiac and went round and filmed it. Mitch jumped in with me.
She's got a big crack, and that crack is starting to get bigger, so a reasonable amount's going to carve off it, and I'm sitting here ready with my audio gear, and it's going to go in the next couple few hours, we think.
So I dropped him off on a rock, and I went round and I took a series of photographs, and then I went back to the boat to get the other guys, and we were getting all the cameras, and they were preparing for a whole, you know, another 16 hours in front of this iceberg.
I sat there by myself while the crew were while the team were getting ready to get all the equipment set up, probably about 50 metres away sitting on a rock. And I had a couple of microphones set up, the stereo mic set up and surround, as well as the surround sound microphone. And it started really moving. And I realised that it probably wasn't too far away. There were large slabs that were breaking off from the top of the archway. And there were parts that were starting to carve off. So I was there on my Todd, and really hoping that the crew would get back so that they could witness it visually. And then she went. And it was, pretty awe-inspiring and a little bit nerve-wracking, because when the whole thing completely collapsed, it sent out a massive shower of large chunks of ice. So in the recording itself, you can actually hear it collapse over a period of time, its final collapse, and then a whole range of baseball, softball-sized pieces of ice spraying all around me, at which point I was diving for cover and just making sure that the microphone was still working, hoping not to get hit.
As we were loading the gear back into the boat, I looked over and could see it, you know, off in the distance, and something looked different about the horizon, and what had happened is the whole archway had collapsed. So when we turned up, Mitch had recorded the whole thing, and he witnessed the whole archway collapsing but we sort of arrived to this destruction. And what happens when an iceberg breaks apart is you get this brash ice in the water, and it sort of splinters. It's reminiscent of coming into a cyclone or an earthquake, and as you come close to the iceberg, you're greeted with this wall of ice cubes. We call it brash ice. So it breaks apart and it spreads out into the water. And so before you can even get to the iceberg, you sort of discover this. And so then we were sort of wading our way through the carnage to get close to it.
So the one that got away for the team, so I feel incredibly privileged that I was able to witness it myself and to be able to record it. And yeah, quite a lovely thing to have all on my own, I suppose, even though the rest of the team didn't get to experience it.
That was episode 2 of the Voice of the Iceberg podcast from a couple of years ago. There are 4 episodes, and you can find all of them at rnz.co.nz or wherever you listen to podcasts. Kei te whakaronga mai, koe ki tō tātou au horihori. Hei hōtaka e pāniki a Papa Tuanuku, Tangaroa, me Rangi Nui. I'm Alison Balance, and you're with Our Changing World on RNZ. Now it's time for a dose of chemistry with Professor Alan Blackman from the Auckland University of Technology and the Elemental Podcast, in which we are celebrating 150 years of the periodic table with a look at every chemical element, from the most interesting to the most boring. So where will tonight's element fall on that spectrum? Let's find out from Alan.
We have got protactinium, and this comes from the Greek protos, meaning first, and actinium, after actinium, the element. It actually forms actinium when it undergoes nuclear decay.
So as we alluded to last time on the podcast about the insights we are gaining into the classical languages, so there's our bit of Greek for the week, but otherwise I'd say this falls into the category of the third or so of elements on the table named for a chemical property. Okay, enough procrastinating and passing the time. Should I be on the edge of my seat for this episode, Alan?
Well, as much of any of them, I really couldn't possibly say, and I'll let you be the judge of that.
Okay, how would you sum protactinium up, apart from the fact that it's got a very nice-sounding name?
It does, rolls off the tongue nicely. Protactinium, I would say, is a very rare radioactive element, which is one of the 10 least abundant elements in the Earth's crust. So, elemental symbol Pa and atomic number 91. We go back to good old Mendeleev, and he predicted the existence of protactinium, but it took at least another 40 years before it was first identified and isolated.
By the way, how many elements did Mendeleev actually predict?
It was actually 4 when he gave a predictive name to when he published his periodic table in 1869. So that was the first version of that. And he added a prediction for what later became known as protactinium in 1871. Its discovery date is given as 1913, and that's the date that the isotope 234 protactinium was discovered. And it was very briefly, appropriately, I guess, named brevium, from the Latin word brevis, meaning brief.
Oh, there's our Latin for the week.
But it wasn't until 1917 that Lisa Meitner, of Meitnerium fame, and we've already talked about her, isolated a quantity of protactinium-231, and that's a long-lived isotope of the element with a half-life of around about 32,000 years. And she called it protoactinium. She described it as being the mother substance of actinium. And it was known as that until 1949, when they shortened protoactinium to protactinium.
Because it sounded better, eh?
Yeah, right. Yes, indeed. So it was an element that not a lot was known about until the 1960s. And in fact, in the 1950s, one of the quotations about protactinium was that it was talked about in terms of, quote, mystery and witchcraft.
So what happened in the 60s?
Well, around about 100 or so grams of the element was isolated from uranium refining residues, and that 100 grams is still being used to this day. Now, I hate to say it, but there's really not much to say about protactinium. We've got the isotope protactinium-233, and that decays to uranium-233, and that is a rare example of a fissionable isotope. And so that could therefore be used in nuclear weapons.
Can I just interrupt? So it can decay from uranium, but it can also decay to uranium?
Yes, indeed. So it depends on which isotope you're talking about. So the lighter ones can decay to actinium isotopes, and the heavier ones can decay to uranium isotopes. I guess the important point about all of this is that there is a bit of concern about nuclear reactors that are powered by thorium. And these were of great interest in sort of around about the 70s or so. Then they fell out of interest. And then recently people have started looking at these again. And in fact, India has got the only such thorium-powered nuclear reactor currently operating. And the reason that there's concern about this is that in such reactors, the protactinium-233 isotope is made. And that could be obtained by reprocessing the nuclear fuel, or in fact, as the reactor is operating, the protactinium-233 is actively extracted because it acts as a so-called neutron poison. It slows the whole thing down. Either way, you don't really want baddies getting hold of this protactinium-233 simply because of the fact that it does then decay to the fissionable isotope of uranium, so that's not going to be good. Ooh, what else about protactinium? Well, you do also get protactinium-233 from the decay of americium-241. And recalling that episode, we know that americium is used in smoke detectors, and so therefore we've probably all got a tiny amount of protactinium in our homes. And I hate to say it, but that's about it.
Oh, sorry, I'm paying attention. I really am. This is quite possibly the dullest element we've done, really.
Yes, but having said that, I'm sure that there is some chemist out there in the world that still loves it.
Thanks, Alan. That was Alan Blackman from the Auckland University of Technology, looking, as always, on the bright side of chemistry. And you can find all the episodes of Elemental posted on the Our Changing World webpage, which is, of course, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. If you're a podcast listener, you can also find Our Changing World, Elemental, Voice of the Iceberg, and of course, the latest episode of the Kakapo Files on most apps, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. If you'd like to get in touch, we are on Twitter and Facebook as RNZ Science. Thanks for your company. Until next time, it's good night from me, Alison Balance, Paul Marie.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.